Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
So, tonight we're going to talk about polarization. As I said here, why everyone should have a little neural anatomy. So, most of the talk about anatomy tonight, you can't help but talk about anatomy and physiology at the same time, of course. And once my mouse associates, there it goes. So, anatomy versus physiology. Those of you guys that aren't bio students, that's half of you. Anatomy is the parts. Physiology is how it works. It's hard to talk about parts without saying what they do and the mechanisms. So, I'm going to talk mostly about anatomy tonight because, frankly, that's sort of what I want to talk about. Sort of mostly gross anatomy, which is the parts of the brain. That said, I'm going to talk a little physiology. We're going to do a lot more physiology on Wednesday when we talk about the electrical and chemical activity in the nervous system. That's totally, well, then we'll do a little cellular anatomy there, but mostly physiology there and a bit of anatomy. So this is more anatomy than physiology, but I will mention some physiology. The brain, and we can talk about any vertebrate brain. We'll talk mostly about human brains, of course, in this class, but, well, I'll have some animal data in here tonight as well. It's organized at best in a semi-random pattern. It is... Oh, why is this here? It's just... It's got to go somewhere. It just bugs me. There's no... Anyway. Yeah, it's semi-random. What I mean by that is, you would think, if you were building a brain from scratch, would you put the part that does... say, vision, right at the back of the brain? I'd put it close to the eyes if I were you. That's what I'd do. Would you lateralize everything so that the left half of the brain and the right half of the brain are doing somewhat different things? You might. But I can make an argument to say I wouldn't do that. Would you take something like memory and... which we don't really quite know how it works, would you put it all over the place and in different systems, or would you make one memory system? I don't know. So the organization of a human brain is actually, well, it's because it's an evolved thing like the rest of us. So evolution works with what it has. It doesn't invent stuff out of whole cloth. So this is what happens. For example, you can look at the eyes, which are often considered really part of the nervous system because they are hooked directly up. Eyes evolved from patches of skin that were light sensitive, right? And some reptiles still have these patches in the back of their necks. They also have eyes, but they have these patches in the back of their necks. And they're light sensitive, and then eventually what happens is it got to be a bit of a... it's more advantageous to be sort of like shaped like a pit. You know, because it focuses the light a little bit. The eye is designed really stupidly because the receptors are at the back, and then it has to go out a little bit through like a bunch of layers of ganglion cells and then go back through the optic nerve, and we have blind spots. That's ridiculous. That's poor design. But evolution works with what it has. So like I said, sometimes it seems silly, but you got to look, if you look at the older forms that things evolved from, you go, okay, I see why it worked like that. I wouldn't build it like that, but you're not building people. Some of the names, by the way, if you don't know Greek and Latin, can be somewhat confusing. And some of the names might make some sense. Substantia nigra, actually, it seems confusing if you don't know about staining things. Because substantia nigra means black stuff. Black substance. And you think, there's nothing black in my brain, except for my soul, which is dark. But if you stain it with silver nitrate, it's black. Oh, that's why. Zona incerta. This is my favorite one. This is Latin for uncertain zone. Because they didn't know what it did. It's in the limbic system. Doesn't matter. It's probably the only time we'll talk about zona incerta. So it sounds great until you know that when the people that named it went, I don't know, what do you want to call it? Some of the names make a little bit of sense. Hippocampus, which I talked about when we talked about the upcoming test. Hippocampus means seahorse. If you speak French, you know the word for seahorse is hippocamp, right? So this is Greek/Latin. And it's shaped, well, it's not like a seahorse at all, but it's seahorse-y. It's seahorse-esque, so it's kind of round like this. But it doesn't really look like a seahorse. It looks like a seahorse if you've been looking at seahorses all day and you've taken mescaline. Amygdala is a Greek word that means almond, and it's actually shaped like an almond, and it's about the size of a big almond and almost as tasty. So that's why it has that name, because of the shape. Okay, so that makes some sense. But again, a lot of these names, these Greek and Latin names, are going to be a bit confusing. And those of you guys that are bio students are used to this crap. The psychology students are like, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. All right, so there's a few key terms. Anterior means at the front. Caudal means from below. So if you had a caudal view of something, and I think I show you one later, if I was looking at a caudal view of a human brain, I'm looking up as if I'm looking up through your throat towards your brain. Okay? Frontal, well, that's an easy one. It means the front. It's a Latin word meaning, no, it's actually English, and it means the front. Inferior doesn't mean bad. It means lesser or below. Lateral is across. Medial is the middle. Posterior is towards the back. Rostral is actually from the Latin word rostrum, which is the Latin word for beak, for a bird's beak. It's towards the nose. And a rostral, so you can talk about rostral cuts, or you can also talk about like certain parts of the brain like that. Sagittal, this is a sagittal plane, cut the body in half. So you'll see a sagittal view tonight of a brain. I'll show you one. Superior is above inferior. It doesn't mean it's any better. It also might mean bigger. It usually means above. So you might talk about like the superior geniculate. That's a part of the visual system. It's the part above. Ventral, towards the belly. And dorsal, towards the back. I always remember that one because of dorsal fin on a shark. That's how I remember that one. So, why do I tell you these things? Because, for example, we can then talk about parts and say we could talk about the dorsal medial thalamic nucleus. And once you know where the thalamus is, you would say dorsal, so that's towards the back, but in the middle. Okay? So the first I thought about that one because the first paper I ever published was, what was it called? Disruption of central place foraging in the rat through lesions of the dorsal medial thalamic nucleus. So we lesioned rats, dorsal medial thalamus. Well, we didn't. A guy named Gord did. They don't let me operate on rats, but with the vision and the lack of training. Other people do the dirty work, please. It's icky. I was involved in the killing, but that's a whole other thing. So that just allows you, you'll see these terms a lot in the book, and I'll throw them out there now and then. So all these things are doing is they're just ways of talking about different parts of the brain and also parts of sort of substructures of different structures of the brain. Because the brain, while it's a whole thing, it's got parts in it that are different. It's so hard to describe it. Unlike, say, something like let's say the heart's got valves, it's got chambers, same sort of thing. So in a brain, you've got different structures that do different things typically. Oh, the outside of the brain isn't chocolate, but it's almost as tasty. I'm kidding. Brains. It's called the meninges. It's a bag. It's your brain bag, basically. In that, you have CSF, cerebral spinal fluid. Okay? Now, your brain's sitting in this sac, And in that sac, there is this fluid. Okay? So, it's a cushion. When a boxer gets knocked out, what happens? Well, how do you get knocked out by being punched in the face? Well, what happens is your brain hits the back of your head. Right? The meninges, which is full of this fluid, is there to cushion that blow. That's the function of that thing. The most common kind of brain tumor in someone under the age of about 40 is actually called a meningioma, and it's actually not a brain tumor technically. It's a meninges tumor. And it's the one people live through. It's not like everybody lives through it, but the prognosis is decent if it's caught early enough. No, the bag. Yeah, the bag itself. So what happens, Rob, is that, and these things can get really big, because typically, because you've got this fluid in there that's cushioning everything, if the meninges gets a tumor, it's going to push, but it's got all that fluid, and that sort of pushes back, right? It's like a...
Well, where's it going? Because the brain is there.
Oh, well, what happens eventually is it causes enough pressure that you end up getting either usually behavioral changes or cognitive changes, or you get like usually a seizure. But these things get to be the size of baseballs before people notice them. Because you've got all this fluid in there cushioning your brain. So that's the one that young people get. So when you hear that like a kid survived a brain tumor, that's the one they get. And that's the one, if you know anybody that gets a brain tumor, you hope that's the one they have. You hope they don't have the one my dad had, which is a glioblastoma. That just kills you. Well, like 1% of people live. For a while, it looked like he was one of them 1%ers, too. The cerebrum, that's just another name for the wrinkly bits of the brain, okay? I thought you'd like that, Jordan. That's why I said that to you. Then you've got the cerebellum, which, and we'll see some diagrams tonight, which is at the back. There's this thing that looks like a little brain, and in fact, that's Latin, literally, for little brain. Okay? So this is really, we're talking really gross anatomy here. I actually went to high school with a girl named Sarah Bell, and of course, we called her Cerebellum. I don't know why I brought that up. I don't know why I remembered it. I don't think I even remember what she looks like.
Is that what the pons in the
blue is? No, that's down in your brainstem. The cerebellum, it's like this self-contained unit. It does, well, we'll talk about what it does later on, but it looks really like a little brain. I should have brought my brain model. I say this every class. And you have various sulci and gyri, or gyri, depending on how you want to pronounce that. Basically, we're talking about the grooves and the bumps. Right? It's the grooves and the bumps. Kirk's favorite one is the dentate gyrus. Important in learning and memory. So these are basically just, these are just the features of, like I said, the gross anatomy. And this is really gross anatomy because we're just talking about there's a brain and a cerebellum and it's lumpy. Sitting, now this is where I'm talking, what Rob said, things like pons. This is on the brainstem. The brainstem itself, this is basically the connection between the spinal column and the brain itself and the wrinkly bits and the stuff underneath it. Really what's going on here are really basic functions, by the way. Super basic functions. Things like sleep and wakefulness. Super basic stuff. So, and what you have, the pons, and that's a Latin word that means bridge, is actually a connection between, see, it's a bridge, between some of these really simple centers that are doing things like sleep and wakefulness, up to, and like the medulla, things like that, up to the cortex, the limbic system and that. So you're going to have connections there that are going to say, wake you up in the morning. It's neural activity, of course, that wakes you up, if you are allowed to actually sleep until you really need to wake up. Which hardly any of us have probably done in ages.
I woke up this morning to my son saying, "Hello, sweetie." Strangest thing. It's the strangest thing. But it was nice. Yeah, it was a little odd. It was my kid calling me sweetie, but, you know, it was nice. It was very pleasant. Then he started talking about pancakes. You know, so, "I'm not making pancakes, kid. I went to bed at 12:30. But the brainstem, just a little, here's a pro tip for you. It's not just to hold your brain up. Because I put brainstem on as one of them definitions once on a test, and someone said, "Function holds your brain up." And, you know, it's actually pretty soft. And if it was just that, your head would just collapse. There's bones in here that do that for you. So that was on the diagram, you know. And it was like, person says brainstem. It's like, it wasn't really pointing to the brainstem, but I'll give credit. It's really pointing to the pons. That's okay. See, like, I'll do that. If it's close enough, I see how you thought that. And said, function holds up brain. No. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. We have cranial nerves. These are these, we got 12 sets of two. I should have said that there. These cranial nerves, they're doing things that are everything from, say, controlling your face muscles to sending out and receiving information down to your spine. Okay, these are exceedingly important. This is why, for example, we talked last week how Christopher Reeve, when he had his neck broken, he was still able to talk, but he needed a ventilator to breathe because he couldn't breathe on his own, because that's down here. He can still talk because the cranial nerves are controlling his face muscles, your tongue, things like that. The brain uses 25% of the glucose in your system and 75% of your oxygen. You want brain food? People always talk about brain food. It's sugar. It is. It's sugar. Unless you're just going to eat a big pile of ATP. And now we know who the biology students are. A lot of your oxygen, quarter of your glucose. Your body runs on glucose, but only the importance of oxygen here, okay? So this is an expensive piece of gear metabolically. You're always feeding your brain. Yeah, Jordan?
I think the textbook has that backwards.
If the textbook's backwards, that means I am right. You're right. It is the other way around. I'm going to change that right now. Because that's annoying. You're right. You are correct, sir. There. Now we shall never speak of it again. I hate when I make mistakes. There's a typo. But it's a stupid one. Okay. Brainstem, cranial nerves, arteries and veins. Right. And because you got to bring 75% of the glucose and 25% of your oxygen, yeah, of course it wouldn't be idiot. All right. So it's expensive. Metabolically expensive, a lot of your food. All right? The amount of energy expended by your brain is unreal. In fact, there is enough current in your brain at any given time to run a major household appliance. There's enough current in your brain to run a fridge. Yeah, because, that's all the glucose is doing, is basically turning into ATP. And then you end up with electrical, chemical stuff going on. There's literally enough to run a fridge. I don't know how you'd do that, and I wouldn't suggest it. But there's enough current in there. So blood's kind of important, hence the arteries and veins. And, of course, on the other hand, what happens here, the blood supply gets cut off, you get a stroke. Which is a word that isn't used too much anymore. Technically, they tend to use the word TIA. Yeah. Transitive ischemic attack. It's a brain attack. That's what it is now. People don't think of it now as a stroke. They use the word, like, it's brain attack. It's the best way to describe it, in all honesty. What happens here, you can either get the blood supply cut off, now you get no oxygen to the brain, and cells die. Or you get, of course, the glucose gets cut off, cells die. If the other possibility is you can have bleeding into the brain, this does what happens here, and this usually is very like big hemorrhages and stuff like that, what's happening there is that the pressure from the blood actually destroys neural tissue. Right? This happens usually, I shouldn't say that. Sometimes this is the fault of something called an aneurysm, which is literally just a weak blood cell, a blood vessel. And then it bursts, and then you get blood everywhere. Other times it's because, let's say, for example, something like a tumor, where the tumor has its own blood supply, and those things are growing pretty fast, and the blood supply breaks. This happens to my father, and you end up with... My dad had such an intense bleed in his brain that the central part of his brain, the corpus callosum, the bunch of fibers that put the two sides together, was shifted over about 3 centimeters. Amazing thing is, the bugger lived 5 more months. Tough son of a bitch my dad was. He was. So, if you take human neuropsych, we'll talk all about that. We're not going to mostly talk about disorders in this class. First of all, it's kind of depressing. And secondly, we'll get there. If you take 2617, the neuropsych, that's in the winter. Just a little plug for my course. Not cross-listed as a biology course anymore, sadly. I blame Al-Qaeda for that. Okay, now again, we're talking about gross external features. Let's talk about gross internal features of the brain. In the middle of the brain, there are these things called ventricles. They're basically, the best way to put it is they're cavities. They're empty spaces. What do? I don't know. And it's not because I'm an idiot. Montreal and Pittsburgh. Oh, Crosby just scored. It's bound to happen eventually. Is he playing in this series? No, it's just... What?
Oh, yeah, I forgot, sorry.
What do you got there?
Montreal won.
Oh, you got there. Rob has a scoreboard, interactive scoreboard over there if you look, and I just thought I'd look on Twitter. Who scored for Montreal, do you know?
Yeah, like 20 seconds into the game.
No, but who scored? Who was it?
Some guy that plays for Montreal.
Some guy that plays for Montreal. Yeah, Rob's not actually a Habs fan. I think it might have been Giant. Sorry, Camilleri from Plekanec and Kostitsyn. All right. Wow. You know, when I was a kid, we got out of school for stuff like that. What do they do? No one really knows what they do. They're full of CSF. The Egyptians, by the way, just a little interesting thing, the Egyptians figured that's where your animal spirits were. I don't mean the Egyptians now. Like, they don't think that. I mean, like, ancient Egyptians. You know, those kind. The ones that walked like an Egyptian. King Tut and the boys. And that's been probably the best theory we've had so far. No one really quite knows what they're for. We got white matter and gray matter. White matter is covered in something called myelin, which is basically fatty substance, glial cells, okay? Gray matter, they aren't myelinated, and we'll talk about myelinated neurons when we talk about cells on Wednesday. Yeah, Dave, please.
Dave,
yeah.
What do we know about the ventricles?
They're nothing. Right, nothing.
That's
yeah.
The anatomical structure on them, if they're smaller.
Yeah.
Yes. With
yeah, there are some things, for example, and Kirk's right, smaller ventricles. People with schizophrenia seem to have smaller ventricles. But seem to is the first thing I said. And secondly, we don't know that that has anything to do with schizophrenia. It may be something that's comorbid with it. I've heard some stuff, the same thing about autism, that there's some ventricle problem. But really, they're just gaps. We don't even know their function. We know they exist. Because they're hard to miss. They're big empty parts. It's a good question, and we don't know. And I mean, it's one of those things, somebody will figure it out, but they're empty. So it's not like they got... There's nothing going on in there. Yeah.
Empty pockets.
Yeah.
What's on either side?
Just brain. Yeah. Yeah, seriously, I'm not being sarcastic. I'm not trying to be flippant. Who knows what it is? Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Like, I like the Egyptians, animal spirits. I think that's good. Jackals. Okay, so let's look at the cerebrum, which is the outer covering kind of thing. Okay, we got four lobes. And a cerebellum. And of course, I am using this from enchantedlearning.com. And I certainly have their permission. So we got four lobes, and then there's a cerebellum. See? It's like a little brain. We got four lobes. We got the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe, the temporal lobe, and the occipital lobe. I can tell you generally what the function of each of these is, the sort of what kind of work they do, but this will be very generally. The frontal lobe is doing complex cognition. This is probably where your personality also lives. Right? Because your personality, part of that's who you are, your sort of how you're consistent, that's what? That's how different people approach different things, different cognitive things. So that makes sense, your personality would live there. But it's also complicated problem solving. One of the reasons we could guess about this before we even knew this is you take a look and our frontal lobe is bigger than any other animal's frontal lobe. Right? We don't have the sloping forehead. Look at a chimp, look at a human. Big difference. They got that sloping forehead action going on. We got a whole bunch of extra head up here to put a frontal lobe in. Right? There's the famous case of an American foreman named Phineas Gage, which is a great name from the 1900s, back when they used to name your kid Phineas. And this guy's working on the railroad all the livelong day. I'm glad a couple of you got that. What happens is a big freaking metal rod goes through his head. Like, sort of like that. Through the frontal lobe. And he lives. And he's okay. Except his personality totally changes. He becomes a jerk. Short-tempered. I'd be short-tempered if I had a big metal thing sticking in my head, too. So I don't think we've factored that out yet. But he totally changes. He goes from being this nice, mild-mannered, pleasant guy, everybody wanted him as their boss, to being, worst boss ever. Right? The kind of guy that when the undercover boss comes, they fire him. It all becomes a reality show in my mind. So we know, and that's in sort of a case study. Also, when people get lesions, they get strokes, they get brain tumors, you will get changes in personality. Right? So that's what frontal lobe is doing. Temporal lobe, doing a lot of stuff, analysis of this is one of these cases, like I said, this makes sense to me where this is. It's dealing with things like language. Oh, look, right beside your ears. That makes sense to me. So if I was building one, that's where I put that. Doing things like language. So in the left temporal lobe, well, we've got right about there, we have Broca's area. And right here, we have Wernicke's area. It's not Wernicke's area. He was German. It starts with a W. It's a V. Okay? So Broca's area controls speech. Wernicke's area controls the production of speech. Wernicke's area is the understanding of speech. The left side is doing meaning. This is very generally. And the right Broca's and Wernicke's area are doing, not doing meaning, they're doing emotion, tone of voice, things like that. So not meaning from the content, meaning from the delivery, I guess you'd say. People with lesions on their right temporal lobe can't tell if you are kidding or if you're being serious when you say something to them. They have trouble getting humor. They can still understand the words, though. Parietal lobe. Up here. Spatial stuff in general. Your sense of left and right lives up there. A lot of visual stuff too, visual and spatial, very closely related. So visual and spatial stuff, this is, for example, where you can get the disorder contralateral neglect, which is exceedingly rare, but did happen when Crazy Joe Davola kicked Kramer in the head. If you've seen that episode of Seinfeld, Kramer gets kicked in the head, but he is wearing Newman's helmet that he traded for a radar detector. And he gets it exactly in the right place. So it's either that someone took a course, looked something up, or that just looked like a good place to put a dent on a helmet. It's possible, too. But if you remember that episode, Kramer gets hit right up about there, right parietal, wakes up in the morning, only shaves the right half of his face, not the left. He's ignoring the left half of the world. And that's a real thing. It is exceedingly rare. But if you take somebody with contralateral neglect, and one of the classic sort of neurological tests is, can you find chalk? Oh, there it is. One of the classic things you do is you have people draw, reproduce pictures. So you give them a circle, and you say, could you draw a clock for me? Sure, I can draw a clock. They draw that clock. All the numbers. And you say, well, okay, fine, that's great. Can you? What's 7 o'clock look like? And they go, yeah, that's easy. Big hands here, little hands there. 7. They still know how to tell time. They still know what a clock looks like. But the left half of the world's missing. Right? Pretty rare. It's called contralateral neglect. You neglect the opposite side, contralateral, so the opposite side of the world from where the injury is. Yes, Stephanie?
Is this also called Kenny field neglect?
That's a different... I think that's a different thing, but I'm not sure, to be honest with you.
Similar?
I think it's similar, though, but it's that's got to do more with... Yeah, it does, but I'm trying to think. I'm not sure, actually, that is the same or not, because I haven't heard that term used, so I don't know. What's that?
We learned about it in Lori's class.
Oh, okay. Well, Lori knows brains. I'll trust her. She's got to do a bird song probably in brains, that's all. Typically, this doesn't happen when you get it on the left side. You don't ignore the right side of the world. You get it on the right side, you ignore the left side of the world. Yep. Typically, with men that are right-handed, and I'm not making this up. I know this sounds like, you know, and on Tuesday, that's not... the stuff about left... being for sort of linguistic stuff and right being for spatial stuff is mostly for right-handed males. It starts to break down a little bit, not too much, but a little bit in women where it's a little more, about 70% have the left half of their brain doing more linguistic function, the right half doing space. It's also, frankly, to be honest with you, I'm talking about straight men. Gay men, their data look a lot more like women on average. But still, most, 70%, still have that left-right kind of organization.
Could they draw a circle?
Draw a circle? That's a very good question. No. Probably not.
The plasticity of the brain and...
How do you mean?
Like,
oh, yeah. Well, the problem is that you... The central nervous system can't be repaired. Well, not on its own.
It can be wired.
Yeah, to a point it can. This depends on... what the area was that was damaged, how young you are, though not nearly as much as we used to think. We used to think like a little kid would get a, like a 2-year-old or a, let's go even younger, a 2-month-old would get a brain tumor and you take it out and there's not going to be any problems. It's not nearly as clear that that's the case anymore. We used to think because development was still going on. You know, stuff with little kids, they lose a finger when they're a week old and they grow the finger back. Like that happens. If you have a baby, I'm not suggesting doing this. I'm just saying that that happens. It doesn't ever happen in adults. So we think the same thing with neurons in the central nervous system. Doesn't seem to be nearly as clear, though it's a little bit better if for a kid. We can also... there's some things you can relearn. For example, people that have strokes in their, say, left temporal lobe may lose the ability to speak. Because let's say it's right at Broca's area. They can sometimes learn to speak again a little bit. They're never going to speak the same as you and I are doing right now. But they can learn a little bit. So there, yeah, plasticity, sure, there's some plasticity. There's no doubt about that. But it's not the same as if you, I don't know, like if you break your leg, it heals. Your brain's not going to do that, unfortunately. That may come. There's people working on this stuff.
Actually, I believe through a course of, it's a long story, but I kind of believe it does. I believe it was much more plastic than we realized.
Well, the thing is, the data aren't there suggesting anything you're saying is true. Oh, yeah, and that's because we're starting to understand how to shut down things like NOGO, which is a chemical that stops neurons from regrowing. There's probably a really good reason for it, too, that it doesn't regrow. And that good reason is that if you've got that kind of injury, and again, you've got to realize that 200,000 years ago, not now, you got that kind of injury, the best thing to do is seal it off rather than try to have rehabilitation. There's not going to be a whole lot of rehabilitation when you're running from saber-toothed tigers. So that maybe that's the reason, right? The day will come. The day will come. I mean, you look at a guy like Christopher Reeve, who actually pumped a lot of his own personal money into researching this because he had money and he had a stake in it, of course. I think we're going to see people, for example, with severed spinal columns walk again. I think that's going to happen in our lifetime. I think that'll happen in 10 years. Yeah. Brain injuries, that's a little more complicated because not only do you have to rebuild the tissue, you have to actually wire it up. That's not quite as complicated as it sounds, but it's complicated.
There was a kid, he was reading at the fifth grade level. He had problems speaking, problem understanding, problem formulating sentence, mm-hmm. problems reading and connecting them together. There's a special school that's been started up. It's in Peterborough. It's in one other place.
Right.
And his task for 2 hours a day was to draw complex symbols and trace them over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
After 6 months, he was able to fully speak and speak at a 10th grade level.
That's great. Now, the question there you have to ask is, that's one person, and it's not controlled. And I'm glad it happened. Don't misunderstand me. When was that published?
Harvard University Medical Center has been doing some research on it.
If you could, you should review one of those articles for your paper, because I'd like to read about it. Yeah, that'd be awesome, if you're into that.
So it has to be a part of the brain where there's stem progenitor cells?
Well, yeah, you might have a case where you've got stem cells, and they can be,
The occipital lobe, there's no stem cells.
No, exactly. In the occipital lobe, if you get something like, for example, a lesion in V1, and we'll talk about what V1 is later in the course, but if you get a lesion in V1, you just don't see anymore, even though you can see. You have what's called blind sight. So we're talking about temporal, parietal, frontal. Yeah, occipital lobe. Yeah, okay. So there's an example. Occipital does nothing but vision. It's all it does. It's got five layers, V1 to V5, V for visual. The first layer actually then sends out stuff to all the other layers, sends out information. So when stuff gets to V1, it's then routed to V2 to 5. Now, the interesting thing here is that you can get a lesion to V1 and you can't see. Except that you throw somebody like that a Nerf ball and they can catch it. But they don't know how they did it and they can't see. It's called blind sight. When my dad, whose brain tumor was 42, right about there-ish, it got big enough that it was pushing back on his left occipital lobe. And I was in the hospital with him watching Canadians play Boston in 2008. And he looked at me and he said, I won't go through all the swearing, but because no matter what happened, he could still swear. It was great. But he looked at me, and this was with his left side, right eye, and he said, I can't see you. I said, yeah, I know. It's because of what's happening. It's pushing on the back of your occipital lobe, on back here. I said, but I want you to try something. He said, well, what do you want me to try? I said, follow my finger. And he was able to do it with his right eye. And I said, can you see my finger? It was in the right visual field. He said, no. I said, see, it's funny, your eye is following it, though. And my brother-in-law, Andrew, looked at me and went, oh, that's cool. he said, how does he do that? I said, it's just a thing. It's one of these things. All this knowledge I have has some use. I can use my father as a guinea pig. So it was kind of interesting when Dad was sick because I was able to not only understand what the neurologist was saying, but also to see some of these things sort of in action. That'd be something good coming out of my dad dying. So, occipital lobe. Pretty cool. We will learn a lot about occipital lobe because we understand vision. We know how vision works. At the end of class tonight, I will show you a diagram of the human visual system. It is awesome. We understand it.
Are your pockets at all?
cerebellum, balance, fine motor skills, things like that. Okay, so important subcortical structures. We're now below the cortex. We are in the below the wrinkly bits. This poor guy had his brain cut off. It's actually just a picture. The things people do for science, though, you know? Okay, hippocampus. Where's hippocampus? There it is, see? Doesn't look like a seahorse. It looks like a question mark, but they thought calling it point interrogative was a lame name for a brain structure, so they called it hippocampus. I don't know how to say question mark in Greek, so I went with French. Really important in memory. Consolidating new memories. Little thing, look at the side. This is, you know, it's scale-ish. It's not really quite the scale, but it's close enough. Because it's trying to be 3D. Okay? Thing about that big, size of your ring finger. That's what's consolidating all new long-term memories. You got one on either side, of course. There's the famous case of HM, who had a bilateral lesion of area CA1 of hippocampus, and after he woke up, he never remembered anything new. So hippocampus is pretty damned important in the humans. In non-humans, it's important in like rats, birds even. It's important in remembering where stuff is. So that's hippocampus. Amygdala. See, it's kind of almondy shaped. And it's right beside hippocampus. It's to do with emotion. It's really, it makes a great deal of sense that it's right beside hippocampus. We remember emotional things, strong emotions, we remember them better than things without strong emotion. That's how human memory works. So again, this shouldn't surprise us that these two areas would be connected together in the limbic system. This is called the limbic system. Thalamus. Right about there. They don't have the thalamus in here. Do they have it labeled? Oh, there it is, yeah. So there's the thalamus. This is sensory information. Everything but smell goes through the thalamus. Hypothalamus. Hypothalamus does all kinds of stuff to do with keeping you... It does thermoregulation. It does eating and not eating. It tells you when to eat and when to stop eating. Ventral medial hypothalamic lesion. So if I took the ventral medial hypothalamus out of you, you just keep eating until you exploded. And you'd feel hungry, by the way. Took out the dorsal medial hypothalamus, you'd never start eating. When we lesioned rats in hypothalamus, we had to tube feed them. So we had to take rats and take a hypodermic needle full of, condensed milk, and put a tube down their esophagus and actually just inject right into their stomach because they wouldn't eat food. That's the part of science that's not in the brochure when they say be a scientist. You have to shove tube down the rat. You have to tube feed a rat. Good times. No, because we had to take them out and we had to have them running around later in a maze. Okay. Nucleus accumbens. Which, nucleus accumbens, not labeled, but, and it's actually not really shown very well here. Got to get a little bit up. They've taken the accumbens out of this guy. It's up about here. Okay. Closer to the cortex. This is your reward, part of your reward system. Yes, everybody loves the accumbens. It's our favorite part of our brain. It's the part of your brain that is activated when you have an orgasm, when you eat pogos. I like pogos. You all do too. You're all sitting here giggling. Everybody loves corn dogs. When you watch The Family Guy, unless you don't find it funny, in which case I question your taste. When you listen to music you like, when you take heroin, when you smoke a cigarette, when you drink alcohol. Yeah. It's a dopaminergic system, yeah. It runs on dopamine. The medulla, which is important in sleep and wakefulness. It's gone. Okay. The brain's divided into two hemispheres, left and right, connected via the corpus callosum. Corpus callosum, Latin for big body. Corpus, body, callosum, big. Not all animals, by the way. So that's how we get the connection between the left and the right part of our brain. Not all animals have a corpus callosum. Most birds do not have corpus callosums, which I'm messing up my Latin pluraling words there. And I don't think pluraling is a word. Birds have a little tiny bundle of fibers. Unlike we have this really thick connection between the two, you know. Birds have this little tiny bundle of fibers right at the back, connecting both halves of their brain. And it allows their two hemispheres to communicate. The neat thing is, and the communication is way slower than it is like with us between the left and right part of our brain. This allows really cool research to be done. Nikki Clayton has done some amazing stuff. Nikki's at, I think she's at Cambridge now. She was at UCSD for a long time. Amazing researcher. Nikki worked on, among other things, food-storing birds. So these birds that store food and recover hours or days later. So she was working on marsh tits, which are like little, same like chickadees, except they live in England. So it's like chickadee-day-day. And every year, and always a little laugh, just a little polite laugh, and I appreciate that. So what happens here is if they store with one of their eyes covered, they store the food with the left eye, sorry, right eye covered. That's left, that's right. The information only goes to the right half of their brain. Right? Because you're wired contralaterally. So, what happens here is then you have the bird go to recover food and you cover the other eye. And now we can't find the food. But you wait 24 hours and then he can recover with either eye because it's all been integrated and gone from both one side of the brain to the other. On the other hand, non-storing birds, you don't get them to store here, you get them to remember a spatial location, it never goes to the other half of the brain. So if you're using great tits, and yes, that's a real kind of bird, and I can then say great tits in class, and there's no issue, Paris major. Or if you're using coal tits, which are also non-stores, blue tits are stores, it's a great place for comparative psychology England. The information never transfers. It's really cool. No, it excites me. It makes me happy. Very neat stuff. Okay, so that's because birds don't have a corpus callosum, so you can do this sort of experiments in nature. It's very neat stuff. All right, questions about that so far? Two hemispheres, left and right.
What kind of experiments?
Well, like that one with the covering one eye. And then they store food, or they try to remember a location, and then you have them try to recover where the food was with the other eye covered, and they can't. But if they're food-storing birds, it takes a little while, and eventually the information goes from one hemisphere to the other. Non-storing birds, it doesn't go to the other hemisphere. It never gets there. Yeah, it's awesome.
Okay, what
about great tits, and blue tits, and coal tits, and marsh tits. Marsh tits and coal tits are the food stores. Great tits and blue tits are non-stores. Yep. They're basically, they remind you of chickadees. They look, if you saw one, you'd say, that's a chickadee, except they're British ones. Yep. Great stuff. Nikki has done some really powerful, cool experiments. Great science. She's about that tall. She's one of the few people I ever met that can drink me under a table, too. I'm serious. We'll talk more about neurons, you know, on Wednesday, but your brain's made up of neurons and glial cells. Neurons are the ones that do the transmitting, the receiving, and the integrating. Glial cells do support. There's a lot of different kinds of neurons, and there's a lot of different kinds of glial cells. And we'll get there. We'll talk about those. But these guys here are doing support. Glia is a Latin word meaning glue. There is a reason I took Latin for 4 years in high school. Because it was fun. It had nothing to do with me thinking I was ever going to do anything with the brain, but that's why I took Latin. So I can say things like, semper ubi sub ubi. It's always wear underwear. They didn't wear underwear and they wouldn't call it sub ubi anyway. It's just, anyway. I can say things like, canis est in mensa stat, pestis, furcifer. The dog is standing on the table, pest, scoundrel. So if I ever go back in time, once my time machine is complete, I can speak to Romans. axons have neurons and dendrites. Neurons have axons and dendrites. Again, we'll talk about this. But basically the notion here, I'm going to make a fool of myself and draw a neuron. And my neuron always comes out looking like a moose. It really does. It's a cell body, and we've got dendrites and an axon. A moose with a big nose. Information flows through the dendrite, down the cell body, to the axon. We'll talk way more about that when we talk about cells. A whole bunch of neurons connected is called a tract, or a nerve, depending on where it is. It's called a tract in the central nervous system and a nerve in the peripheral nervous system. Like, that's your ulnar nerve, you know that one? Right, so if you do this, I love doing this, kind of enjoy it. Give it a little. There it goes. And you feel the, moves your fingers, and you get that little zzz. It's not a funny bone, it's a funny ulnar nerve. All right, now we talked the other day about the central nervous system, the peripheral nervous system, our autonomic nervous system. This is really about anatomy, and that's fine. And in fact, there is something special about the central nervous system, and that's the pretty much irreparable, when damage happens, it's pretty much irreparable. Whereas the peripheral nervous system, it's a little easier for it to fix. Because if it didn't, every time you got a cut, you'd be numb everywhere where you had a cut in your life. Right, and that's not the case. Right? Though if you get pretty severe damage, peripheral nervous system, the neurons don't grow back properly. My thumb is, this part of my thumb here, if it's hard to notice, but it's flat because I sliced it off with a cleaver once. And then that was in our sauce, our spaghetti sauce, and I just kept cooking. What are you going to do? Throw a whole thing out? I was in school. We didn't have any money. It's meat. You know, it's just going to cook down. No, I'm serious. I mean, it's a little tiny piece of thumb. It was mostly skin. And my thumb's all numb right there and flat. There's nothing wrong with the CNS-PNS distinction, but it's not as much about physiology as anatomy, okay? Because physiologically what's happening is anything that's going from your central nervous system out to your peripheral nervous system so you can, you know, dance. I don't know. I thought of something and didn't go very far. But nonetheless, you've got to go out from the head, from the brain, down through the spinal column, and then out to your limbs. Right? So, whereas when you're talking about up here, it's all basically running your head and your rest of your brain. So the idea there is we can also talk about the cranial nervous system and the spinal nervous system. It's just another way to look at it. Both are fine. So physiologically, a lot of times, talk about cranial nerves, cranial nervous system, and the spinal nervous system. So cranial, head, so brain and cerebellum, spinal nervous system, well, that's probably the spine now, isn't it? Right? And then out to your limbs, etc. You'll see both. Both are fine. Nothing wrong with them. Like I said, 12 sets of two cranial nerves. They basically control inputs and outputs from stuff in the head. Right? They control your facial muscles, your tongue, things like that. And again, this is why someone with a broken neck may not be able to breathe, but they can talk. Right? The brainstem itself gets input from the senses. When I say there, I don't mean the senses. I meant like touch and like the touch senses. And there's four of them. Remember when you were in school and you learned there were five senses? That is a lie. There's heat, there's cold, there's pressure, and there's pain. There's four already. Vision's got its at least three senses. Brightness, intensity, motion, color, and motion. So that's four. Yeah, color and motion is different than color or different than motion. You can get a very specific lesion to your occipital lobe where as soon as that lesion happens, things that move are in black and white. It's like being in an aha video from 1983. That's really, really rare, by the way, okay? It's not something that happens all the time. And yeah, by the way, yeah, so you could have a lesion of V3 where as soon as things move, they disappear. So you know what happened then? Imagine that. You're crossing the street, and I'm not trying to be flippant here. People get these lesions, and they have to have a guide dog, even though they can see. Because think about it. If there's no cars coming on the street, that either means there's no cars, or it's full of cars. No, I'm serious. I mean, it'd be easier to be blind, I bet. I bet it'd be easier to be blind. So yeah, that's the, as I said, the brainstem's getting stuff from all the touch senses, and there's four of those. The brainstem sends outputs to the rest of the body, not the head then. Okay? So down through the spine. We'll talk, whoops, hit my microphone there. We'll talk a bit more about this tonight as well. You can divide the brain itself into the hindbrain, the midbrain, and the diencephalon. This is another way to look at it. Hindbrain, midbrain, diencephalon, just like you'd expect.
Two,
die, encephalon, encephalization. It's Greek for brain, encephalus. Yep. Because there you're not talking just about the two lobes. You're talking about everything that's underneath it too. Like if you talk about a bird, you can talk. Birds don't have a whole lot of cortex, if any. But they do have different two halves of their brain. So we can talk about the left diencephalon and the right diencephalon. Yep. The hindbrain, so here we're talking cerebellum, stuff like this. This is doing fine movements. This is doing balance. So the cerebellum, it may be important as well in learning. It may have something to do with time perception. To learn things properly, you have to know when thing A happened to see if A causes B, don't you? So it looks like it's got something to do with that. Also, quick movements, really lightning fast movements. If you take a look at, think about something like a frog. What can frogs do that you can't do? They can catch insects from the sky with their tongue. You can do that, but you choose not to. I mean, what I'm saying is sometimes when you breathe in a bug, you ever do that? Yeah, but you didn't do that on purpose, where frogs are doing it on purpose. If you take a look at a lot of these amphibians and reptiles that do these quick movements, they have a huge cerebellum compared to what you would expect. So really quick movements. Then we're moving up, we get to the reticular formation, sleep and wakefulness. There's connections here to the cortex. Again, as I said before, this is what wakes you up.
Would this be effective depression, obviously?
I don't know.
Yeah.
In all honesty, I would imagine.
I thought it was input stimulus.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, please. First, you have to detect light, right? And which then sends a signal down to the reticular formation that says, wake up.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the amount of stimulation is controlled by it, right?
Yes. That's right.
So if like you're extrovert or introvert?
Oh, that I don't know, Kirk. I've never heard that before.
No?
It may be true. Just don't know that stuff.
Eisenach.
Eisenach?
Eisenach, yeah. That's his theory.
Yeah, well, he was kind of nuts.
Was it?
Yeah, a little bit. He also did some really good stuff, though, too. It's hard to know with Hans Eysenck. But half the stuff he did was really good. And then he had this weird thing about how much he hated Irishmen. No, he really had a thing. He had a thing about Irishmen. It was really weird. There's something kind of weird about Hans Eysenck. He had a bit of a Rushton in him, if you know who Phil Rushton was or is. A bit of that angle. A bit of that racist thing, I'd say. But then he also did some really good science. So he wasn't really a neuro guy, though. He was really a personality psychologist, right?
Yeah.
He's the guy with the introvert, extrovert, neurotic,
neurotic,
and stable. That's the two things. Personality psychology. I took personality in 1985. I don't know. something like that.
Yeah, that's what he said was if that's too much stimulation into the brain, you become more of an introvert.
Okay.
It's like it's too much stimulation.
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, but that sounds so simplified. It sounds like something somebody would say in the 1950s. Yeah, which is where he was around. And he did some good stuff. He also had some crazy stuff. Like I said, hated the Irish. I'm not making that up either. I'm not just picking the Irish. Midbrain, tectum, superior collecular. Okay, the tectum is basically the roof of the midbrain. We're getting just up before the cortex, okay? Within the tectum, there's the colliculi, so there's the superior colliculus that's doing vision, and the inferior colliculus that deals with audition. Well, when we talk about vision later on in the course, second last class, I think, actually, we'll talk about these different streams of information that are coming in. Just below the tectum is the tegmentum. It's also important in movement and vision. Movement for... action for vision, so knowing to do that, to look over at you, that kind of thing, it's important for that. All right. Now we get into the two halves, diencephalon. There we go. Here we are again. It's that same guy we put his head back on. Hypothalamus, which, as I said before, does hunger, thirst, sex, and thermal regulation. This is homeostasis. Keeping you at a steady state. If you get too hot, you sweat. You get too cold, you shiver. You're hungry, you eat, then you stop. You're horny, you're sexy. I don't know how that works, but... The thalamus... There's your thalamus now. They're very good. The thalamus is like your router. It used to say switchboard in my thing, but then I realized, it always says sensory switchboard, but then I realized a few years ago that I'm probably the only person in the room that's ever seen a switchboard. That's how they used to route telephone calls. So, and if you watch Mad Men, you've seen the switchboard. That's about the only place you've probably seen one. Love Mad Men. Yeah, isn't that a great show? Oh, July 25th, it comes back. Wikipedia told me that. So, all this, except for us now, everything is going through thalamus. And I like to think of it's like your router at home. Right? Most of you have a router, right? Because you have your little home network. What's happening here is stuff is coming in from the internets and it goes to the proper computer, doesn't it? Right? So you got your Xbox 360 and you're playing the Halo Reach beta. So information from Xbox Live is coming to your router, and then the router says, go to the Xbox. And then you're watching the YouTube videos, somebody else's, that stuff's coming into the internet, it says, go over here. And then you're BitTorrenting completely legal content that you haven't stolen, and that comes to that computer, or the giant server in your back room. So, this is like that. All the sensory information, while it comes from different places, eyes, ears, is then sent to the right place for analysis by this, what is in essence, a router. Okay? All right. Want to take a little break or want to keep going?
It's too light, Pittsburgh.
Either way, do you want to take a little break or do you want to keep going? You think you're going? Okay. The forebrain, that's the lobes. So now we're talking about the lumpy bits. Collectively, we call that the cortex. Just below what we call the neocortex, which is the wrinkly parts, is the limbic cortex, also called the old cortex. It's called that because it's evolutionarily older. And this is where things like hippocampus are and amygdala. Right? The very top of this, we've got the basal ganglia. This is important in movement. The substantia nigra is there. This is a system, the substantia nigra runs on dopamine, And if you don't, if your substantia nigra is screwed up, in other words, you don't have enough dopamine in substantia nigra, you get, excuse me, you get Parkinson's. Okay? And you might think, well, if it's not enough dopamine, why don't we just give people with Parkinson's dopamine? Because it doesn't fit through something called the blood-brain barrier. Think of the blood-brain barrier like a sieve. It's basically just glial cells that are going around blood vessels. Okay? Now, the problem is, dopamine, you think, well, just inject them with dopamine. It won't get in. They'll never make it in. So what you do is you give them a precursor to dopamine called L-DOPA or levodopa. And that's actually spelled like this, L-DOPA. Okay? I tell you how to spell it because on a test once, when I was an undergraduate, I spelled it like that.
That's a
nice thing. Yeah, L-DOPA! And the prof wrote on it on my test, it's a precursor to dopamine, Dave. It's not a matador. So, L-DOPA. It's my matador impression. I don't bring it up very often. So, that's what typically, and other drugs now are used as well. The limbic system, hippocampus, amygdala. We talked about this for memory. I wrote the reason why I had a question mark there for emotion. Well, it's interesting. Before people knew that amygdala was important for emotion, which we know now it's important for strong emotion, people didn't know what it did. And people didn't know where emotion was. They said, I bet that's where emotion is. One of those weird guesses. Turns out, in fact, though, it is for strong emotion, anger, fear, surprise, things like that. The nucleus accumbens that runs on dopamine. Again, this is that part of your reward system. The accumbens is there. Part of the accumbens is also connected. So it goes, the accumbens is connected to the ventral tegmental area, the VTA, which is connected to the MFB, the medial forebrain bundle. That's the whole reward circuit. When that circuit is activated, that's when things feel good. Okay? So, and that runs on dopamine. That's also a neurotransmitter that we will talk about. But that circuit runs on dopamine. And there's a lot of ways to activate that thing, like I said, and I mentioned them before. Yeah?
When they say bundle, like forebrain bundle, what is that, a bundle of nerves?
Or? Yeah, a bundle of nerves, just like me. Yeah, it's a ganglion, like a whole bunch of neurons. Yeah. There's your olfactory bulb up there, too. It's right at the top. If we're doing a caudal view, we're looking straight up, we'd see these two little bulbs, right? About size of a 5-cent piece from before there were nickels, but that doesn't help anybody, does it? 5-cent silver. They were smaller than dimes. I'm just trying to think. I don't know why I thought. I was going to say dime, but it's smaller than dime. They're for olfaction, the olfactory bulb. This is the only system we have where the sensory system, it does not go through the thalamus. So it's an ancient system. It's a chemical sense. Smell's a chemical sense. It's the oldest sense evolutionarily. Ours is really small. We're not very good at smelling. You take a look at the olfactory bulb in an owl, it's bigger. A lot of nocturnal birds, nocturnal animals have much bigger olfactory bulbs, you know, based on their brain size, body weight, than we do. Because they do a lot more smelling. We see. Okay, the spinal nervous system. That poor guy, first they cut his head off, now they've dyed different parts of his skin. So the spinal column, we have a nerve running to and from the spinal column that controls and receives input from that part of the body. These parts of the skin are called dermatomes. Okay? So we have these different, along our, you see right here, along your spine. This is why, for example, you can do a neurological test. You'll go into the doctor, and you might say, for example, my leg, is numb. And the doctor will say, really? And they'll take a pin, and they'll go, how about here? Does that hurt? Go, no, I can't feel anything. What about there? Ow, that hurts. So that's actually a pinched nerve in your back, right? Because the stuff has to travel to and from your brain along your spinal column down to that part of your skin. This is why, for example, and of course, anything below that, so if you get your spinal column severed, everything below that part and below, you're not going to have any feeling or any movement. Okay, so the dermatome is a part of the skin, and this is the same on everybody. Doesn't matter what your culture is or what your upbringing is, right? It's going to be the same on everybody. And see the face? Remember that? Remember I said about the face, though? Cranial nerves, different thing altogether, right? But then we get into the anything else. It's spinal, and this is why, for example, you can see that. Take a look here. You could be paralyzed and numb right there, right? Or sorry, that part could work, but the outer part wouldn't work, and your hand wouldn't work. So you would actually technically not be paralyzed right in there, but you wouldn't be able to move your arm very much. Right? So somebody that's been all the way up to the top, right to there, the only place they're going to have any feeling is the top of their head. That's what Christopher Reeve had, right?
Is this a C2 fracture?
Yeah, I think it was C2.
C2, yeah.
I think it was. And those are, yeah, that's pretty nasty. Yeah. But this is why, for example, if you get a pinched nerve, you might feel your legs be numb, or get muscle knots in your legs, or tingling sensation, pins and needles, things like that.
Can you clarify exactly what the dermatome is?
Yeah, so there's parts of your, like, there are areas of skin, okay, that correspond to that part of your body being controlled. Control is the wrong word. Yeah, well, controlled and also getting sensory information goes from, say, here, right? So if I touch myself right there, okay, there is a sensory neuron there that with just a whole bunch of it just fired, then went back down through my spine to about there, right? As you can see on the diagram, because I hit myself right about there. See? So it's going to go right about there to my spine and up to my brain and right up to left.
Why does it have to go to your spine?
That's just how we're wired.
That's weird.
Yeah.
So your dermatomes are actually the neurons?
They aren't the neurons themselves. They're actually parts of they're skin that are served by different neurons and muscle.
Skin that's served by
That's right. Yeah. So that's why movement and sensation. Remember I said we can talk about the spinal nervous system doing movement and sensation. Everything has to go through the spine. It either goes from here to the brain I just touched my arm. Or if I want to do that, it's going from my brain to my arm to do that. But it always goes through my spine. That's why when you get a broken back and you actually sever your spinal column, you can end up, say, everything here and below, you're going to be paralyzed. Whereas you might end up, if it's really low down, you might end up just being the back of your legs here. Yep, and that's true in any vertebrate.
Your muscles surround these nerves, don't they?
Sorta, yeah.
Do you think that flexibility could increase someone's small intelligence? Then if it increases your blood flow, increases your circulation, it increases your nerve firing.
Intelligence is probably much more served by... Though I will say that there are a lot of data out there that suggests that people that are smart, people with high IQs, are better at athletics. Yeah, but it's hard to know. It's probably not a whole lot so much to do with that as it is to do with the fact that if you're smart, you're also... Smart people tend to be better looking, tend to live longer... just better genes in general.
Because the exercise makes new brain cells.
Well, I mean, you only make new brain cells where there's stem cells. Yeah. Would you say, Kirk, you some sort of smart-ass remark back there? How does it sound circular? Oh, I don't know. I said it's just good genes.
Well, yeah. Could your intelligence would be high because you're good looking, or
I don't think, in fact, in that case it matters because, like I said, it's just like it probably detects things. It's probably correlated with parasite load or something like that, like it is in birds. So inside the spinal column, you get the dorsal root, which is from this sort of a diagram we were just talking about, from the sensory receptors and the ventral roots to the movement. So dorsal, closer to your back. Yeah, sorry, Austin.
Just like that camillary just tied it up.
Nice. Le but du Canadien compte pendant le 13. Mike Camilleri! Feel free to do that whenever you want. Don't make them up, though, because then I'll get angry. Remember during the Canada-Belarus game, 2002 Olympics, semifinals? I had a little TV, and I just took it to my class, and I just had it sitting there, and I would say, put up your hand whenever you want to update in the score. So, thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. This is what we were talking about before, dorsal root, ventral root. The dorsal root, so this is going to be the back part of your spine, your spinal column. This is from the sensory receptor. It's too bad you can't see that very well. Damn. I wonder if I can get a better... If I do this, maybe you'll be able to see it, but yeah, it's a bit better. So what we have here, right, it goes in, top part of the spine, up to your brain. Ventral root, okay, there's a nerve running down, from your brain, the same part of your spine, out to that dermatome. Does that make sense?
Can you say that again?
Yeah, sure. So the dorsal root, okay, this is doing sensory information. So let's say, well, let's go with C2, because we just talked about a C2 injury. So that's like the dermatome for C2 is right about back here. Okay? Back of your head. Front of your head is controlled by cranial nerves. Back, different. Spinal. So, I'm touching the back of my head. Right? The left side. What happens is, and this sounds weird again, would you build it this way? Goes down till it gets to about there. Doesn't have to go very far. C2 is right about 1, 2. It's right there. Okay? And it goes in to my spinal column, and then comes back up to my brain. It's a loop. On the other hand, now I can't really manipulate the back of my head, so let's, if I'm using my right arm, let's go with, moving these two fingers, you can actually feel that nerve, the ulnar nerve. That's going to go, if I'm controlling this, okay, from this part of my brain, left, so motor cortex, right about there, okay, down through my spine, and we're coming out there, that's what? Not L, that's more, what are we talking here? C8, looks like. Yeah, and so C8. So C, down about 8, so it's about there, okay? So what's had to happen is it's come from here, down through my spinal column, through this ventral root to the back part of my spine to control these two fingers. It's always going, it's like, as Rob said, it's like a loop. It's going from your, and it goes the same route except it's dorsal, if it's sensory, it's ventral, if it's motor. But it goes to the same part of your spine. Whoa, it's bright, eh?
Spot check,
gold. Just happy with that. That's good. Spot check, he's like been hurt. And he's not a good goal scorer. I'm not going to get excited. No, you wouldn't believe if I was at home, I'd be different. Yeah. My daughter agrees. I don't yell anymore and stuff like that, except at the very end of games. Just hockey. When it's the Olympics, it's life or death, and that's different. And this is our game, this is our country. But this is just the NHL. So, does everyone understand how this works now? Why is it like this? I don't know. Evolutionarily, if you look at the first things that had something that looks kind of like a spinal column. So here we're talking about some worms, and they don't have spines, okay? Because they're worms. They also don't have their nervous system. They don't really have a brain. They've got a bunch of enlarged ganglia going along down, but they do at the very top of the notochord, which is a little spinal column, have a bigger part. It looks like kind of like a brain. They have these dermatomes on them too, except that they're circular because it's a worm. So this is something that happened a long time ago, and it worked. And like I said, evolution just builds on what it had before. This is called the Bell-Magendie law, the idea that the dorsal root is from the sensory and the ventral root is two movement. That's the Bell-Magendie law. This is one of those excellent definition questions, one might say. And everyone starts writing it down. Want the light back, or do you want me to leave it off? Like it better like this? I like it better like this. Yes, Stephanie.
Isn't this more of an observation? Like the Bell-Magendie
law? Oh, yeah, it's more of an observation than a law.
Can they just put their name on?
Yeah, I think so. They probably did. They discovered it, I guess. Yeah, it's like that Nesbitt's paradox thing in Neurofarm, right? Yeah. Hey, it's always like this. Want to put our names on this? Excellent. Want to be famous? All right. Now, the other one we can talk about is the internal nervous system, the autonomic nervous system. This is basically the fight or flight response. So the sympathetic part of that does arousal, and the parasympathetic does cool down.
So is there also the freeze in that 2 days before and after?
The which?
Fight, flight, or freeze.
Well, I haven't heard that. That's not very adaptive. Unless freeze means play dead.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, playing dead works. I mean, like, there are animals that play dead, so I'm not. That's why I'm wondering this. I'm not trying to be facetious. Yeah, I never heard about the other F though. This is all hormones, right? This is epinephrine and norepinephrine, getting you going, getting you ready to fight or run away, to bravely run away, like brave Sir Robin. Pretty much all of what goes on here is hormonal. We talked about psychoneuroendocrinology the other night. And no one got my reference to the Holy Grail with Brave Sir Robin, but I'll just keep moving on. We're not going to talk much about this. We should have a course in like neuroendocrinology, but I don't think we have anybody who could teach it. So it'd be cool. Here's some principles of nervous system organization. These are general principles. The sequence goes like this. Input, integrate, output. Stuff comes in. It's integrated. So in other words, there's all kinds of other neurons help to make decisions here. And then you get output. Output typically is behavior. But it doesn't have to be behavior. It could be thinking. Okay? It could be cognition. That's how you think about it. That's when you look at, like, say, wiring diagrams. There's a functional division between sensory and motor systems. They're inextricably related, obviously. We just talked about dorsal and ventral root. If you look at motor cortex and sensory cortex, they're right beside each other, and the part that controls your right hand is right beside the part that feels for your right hand. They're inextricably linked, but they are functionally separate. Which seems really, really, really weird. This is another one of those cases, I wouldn't build it that way. Inputs, outputs are crossed. Do we just saw that? Right? That's the Bell-Magendie law again. We have symmetry and asymmetry. This is one of my favorite principles of nervous system organization. It says we have this, and on the other hand, the exact opposite of it. We have symmetry in that, I was saying all night. You've got a left one of these and a right one of these. A left Broca's area, right Broca's area. You got a left parietal lobe, right parietal lobe. So that's the symmetry. The asymmetry comes in when different parts do different things. So I talked about emotion in speech versus meaning in speech. We have excitation and inhibition, right? And the interesting thing is, for example, why am I doing Shatner? To walk, you have to know, you have the excitation to move your legs, but you also have enough inhibition not to walk like John Cleese doing the silly walk in the Ministry of Silly Walks. Right? So you got to walk properly. Right? You don't do the... like that. That's inhibition. Right? Knowing how far to reach for something. So if I want to reach for Austin's cup there, I know when to stop. So there's always excitation, there's always inhibition. It's good that's empty because I put my paws all over it and a shower before I came, but nonetheless. We have multiple levels of function. Think about, let's briefly talk about vision. I talked about how you have this first area called V1. Now this is way after the eyes and after these different routes through the tegmentum and all that stuff we talked about tonight. But we have the different levels, multiple levels of function. For example, vision, you've got V1 that is sending visual input to go, you go to V2, you go to V3, you go to V4, you go to V5. Oh, by the way, some of you go to V1 and V2 and V3, or sorry, V2, 3, 2, and 3. Things like that. Because it's sending information out for processing. We have a visual system. The visual system in the back of our brain, the visual analysis system, is doing a lot of stuff at the same time. But there's all kinds of different levels of function. Excuse me. The nervous system is massively parallel, and it's hierarchical. This is called the Hewlings-Jackson principle. This was found by a guy named Hewlings-Jackson. And maybe it's kind of like another one of Stephanie's observations, but I think he was a pretty good neurologist, though. So, what's this say? Let's think about recognizing an object. You probably have all taken intro psych. You're supposed to have. Okay. Think about recognize an object. Oh, well, I was going to draw something, but again, I can't find the chalk. Here it is. All right. It's a triangle. That wasn't hard, was it? Now, so let's call it, say it's shaded. Let's pretend that's it's red. It's a red triangle. You know how your retina works a little bit, right? And if you don't remember this, you know, it's got different receptors in the back of your eye that detect when something is, when light hits it. That's all you have to know. There's about 130 million of those in each eye. They're neurons. Okay? So it's 130 million, but they're all focused, most of them, in your fovea, which means, you know, we have about 600 megapixel eyes, which is pretty good. There's a new phone coming with that next week. But, no, there isn't. That's a joke. So, you've got to know what color, or first of all, did a photon of light hit my eye or not? Right? Your eye has to know that. It has to send out the information up to, back eventually to your occipital lobe. Right? It's got to know this. And if there's 130 million receptors in each eye, and that's a pretty decent estimate, it's got to do what? It's got to read the state of all of those receptors at the same time, roughly. Doesn't it? Because if it didn't, if it read them at one after the other, you'd have to stare at that for a long time. Let's say it took a tenth of a second for each to know each state, a hundredth of a second, a millisecond. It's still going to take you... about what? 13,000 seconds then... to read the input of your eye all the time. How long is 13,000 seconds? Long. That's more than a day. Wow. So it must be reading the inputs all at the same time. Right? Has to be. Or you wouldn't recognize anything. So that's parallel. That's parallel processing. Oh, by the way, while you're doing that, also your brain is regulating the fact that you're breathing. It's regulating your blood sugar. It's monitoring it and regulating it. It's... knowing what the words I'm seeing are, it's able to read that up there. It's thinking about what's happening in a hockey game for some of you. Some of you aren't caring. Again, I question your patriotism if you don't care. And I'd like to see your passport. All these things are happening at once. Other things are being ignored at the same time. Until I told you right now, those of you wearing watches, you didn't even notice you were wearing a watch until I mentioned you're wearing a watch. Oh, yeah, I guess I can feel it now. You were ignoring that. You were purposely ignoring that. You're seeing in three dimensions. All of these things are happening at the same time. That's Pella. You couldn't be doing these things one after the other. We would have never been able to build a wireless Bluetooth mouse without any buttons. Stupid Apple. I don't like buttons. But stuff has to travel from my eyes, has to eventually get routed through thalamus, etc., back to my visual cortex, which then sends it out for analysis. That's hierarchical. We're going from simple to complicated. So to simply recognize that as a, was supposed to be red, triangle, I have to not only recognize the pattern of light, but I have to recognize these angles, I have to recognize the color, I have to recognize the colors here and not here. I have to also be able to, at the same time, keep, you know, breathing and thinking and know what the word red and triangle mean. Right? That's a pretty huge thing. So we're doing things hierarchically and in parallel always. That's maybe one of the biggest take-home messages, in fact, of the whole course, is that the nervous system is hierarchical and parallel. All right. In the nervous system, things are localized and distributed. Localized, for example, I said there's a center that controls speech. I said there's a center that controls reception of speech. There's a center that controls, or a circuit that controls reward. But there's also distributed processing. Your whole brain's always doing something. Even when cells aren't firing, that means something. The pattern of activation means something. And it depends on whatever the hell it means, but because it can mean anything. You got to 10 to the 14th of the damn things in your head. Yeah, I am. So you've got a case here where at all times you have localized processing. Right now you're understanding what I'm saying, I hope. But you're also writing things down. You're listening to me. Parts of your brain are more active than other parts, but it's not like those parts that aren't active right now don't mean anything if they're not active. That pattern of activation, and we'll talk about it, it's called a cell assembly. We'll talk about that much later in the course. It means something. It's representing something. And I'm not saying something because we don't know and it's all a mysterious void. I'm saying that it could be all kinds of things right now. There's always, just because something isn't firing right now doesn't mean it's not in use. Ones and zeros, man, it's binary. So, we have localized function and distributed function. This is where when someone tells you, and someone inevitably will in your life, that we only use 10% of our brains, I want you to look at them and say, what 90% would you like me to remove? Because you're using all of it, all the freaking time. The idea, just because something isn't firing, it still means something. Okay? Now I'm going to show you a diagram. This is a simple version of how the human visual system works. Don't worry, you don't have to know this.
It's just the diagram I was going
to
ask.
Yeah, that's the diagram. That's the simple version, though I'll actually explain this to you later in the course, not this diagram, but I'll explain the principles here, and you'll be able to look back at this and understand it. The cool thing here is that, remember I talked about parallel and hierarchical? There's got to be hierarchy here. It's a flow chart. All flow charts are hierarchical. But we've also got things happening in parallel, don't we? Because everything at each level means these things are happening at the same time. There's thalamus right there. Oh, look, accumbens. There's accumbens. Right? Pretty damn cool. And this is, see, it's controlling. We're talking about eye movements as well. So it's there's vision for action, action for vision. Action for vision is things like looking at something, moving your head, moving your eyes, etc. So all these things are happening. And the our visual system, which is the one we really understand, if we're going to talk a lot about vision because we get it. It's like an intro psych. I spend a day and a half on vision. They said, and then there's hearing. It's about sound. Okay, moving on. We get it, but it's pretty simple. And then there's taste, which we don't really, well, we get, but no one cares. You know. All right? So I thought I'd end on that. The point is, that, in fact, you'll understand most of this stuff, most of this diagram by early June. All right? And on that note, let's go watch hockey. Thanks, guys. Oh, I don't know if I can take going straight through like that all the time. Man.
Can't wait. And if you say that can't wait. And if you say that you love me tomorrow, tomorrow is too late. I need you to say that you love me.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.